Open up to 2 Samuel, a quick review of where we left off is that Saul's dead now. Remember, he went into battle against the Philistines, and it was actually God that told him, this is actually going to be your end, you and your sons. And so through Samuel, remember Samuel told him, this is it, you're going to come be with me in this battle. So Saul died with all of his sons, and Saul fell on his own sword. And just as Samuel had prophesied, they all died. And the enemies of God used that to bolster themselves against Israel. And so they beheaded Saul and his sons, pinned their bodies on the wall of Bet-Shean, and then the men of Jabesh-Gilead came and honored Saul by taking the bodies down and giving him a rightful burial. And so then we got more details on the death of Saul in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. So we won't spend a lot of time on that because we talked about it last week, that the Amalekite, remember, came upon him and took his crown and his bracelets and brought them to David and said, you know, Saul and Jonathan are dead. And how is it that you have these? And he says, well, I came upon him and slew him for you, you know, kind of thing. And David says, this is not wise, you know. And it's almost like the guy was saying, you didn't have the guts to kill Saul, so I did. It's kind of, you know. But David tells him, you know, why wouldn't you have feared lifting your hand against God's anointed? And so David has him killed right there. So that's where we left off. So we'll kind of recap here. Chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag, on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And so it was when he came to David that he fell to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, where have you come from? And he said, I have escaped from the camp of Israel. Now, this is the part that we're not going to really spend that much time on. You can flip over where he says in verse 8, who are you? So I answered him, this is Saul and him talking. He says he's an Amalekite. So remember we talked about this? God had told Saul to destroy the Amalekites. Did Saul do it? No. So it's interesting that an Amalekite, in the story here at least, takes Saul's life. Now, I'm going to say that the account we have in 1 Samuel where Saul falls on his sword and dies, and his armor bearer sees that he's dead, so he too takes his life. That whole story is probably what really happened. This guy is taking credit, thinking that he's going to get a reward from David. There's nowhere in the story that it says that his account was actually true, because it's a little bit of a conflict with the previous account. But anyway, the application is amazing that the Amalekite ends up being his demise. And so he tells this story. David tells him, you know, that was not wise for you to do, and commands for him to be killed there in verse 16. So really, we're going to pick it up now in verse 17. But before we do... You know, the flesh and the spirit are always at war, right? And so Saul did not deal with the things that God was doing in his life. He did not surrender to the Lord, didn't walk by faith. And so it ended up being his demise. But I want to point something out to you. This guy, this Amalekite, was trying to show loyalty to Saul, and it was not a good excuse for acting corruptly in his story. I took his life, you know. He thought that would be honorable towards David trying to show loyalty to Saul by not letting him be at the hands of the enemy was not a good answer to David. And so the application I'd like to make here is that the Amalekites are a picture of the flesh. And the flesh will always come up with some weird excuse for what it does in our lives. And the world, the unbelieving world, will give you the strangest reasons why they don't come to faith. You know, it's been said there's only one thing smaller than a hypocrite, someone who hides behind one. And how many people have we met that reject Christianity because all the churches are full of hypocrites? So they're hiding behind a hypocrite. So we want to ask for wisdom from heaven when we're fighting the world's reasons for their unbelief. Now, this isn't really in our, I'm departing from our text really to make this analogy, but there'll be a fictional book, sometimes made into a movie, that discredits Christianity, and the world will watch the movie or read the book. Which one is it? What is the one I'm thinking of that was a big deal several years ago? The Da Vinci Code. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh, see, Christianity is just corrupt and it's all a myth. They'll buy into that. They won't do any research as to whether or not there's even any legitimacy to the story. But the story was written with the intent to deceive. Brown was his name or whatever, wrote that whole story knowing that he was not giving the correct history of Christianity. He was just pointing out some things that made for a good story and all of that. But his intent was to deceive. And there's historical revisionists with a dishonest agenda even today. They're totally disingenuous. So when you listen to the news and you hear all the reports against Israel, and you think, what is all that about? What is all that about? There's so much disinformation. You know the difference between misinformation and disinformation? Misinformation is unintentionally the wrong information. Disinformation is intentionally the wrong information. So there's times when I'm reading things online about events in the world, and it's obviously historical revisionist. They've got a private agenda. They're pushing it. And I just kind of think, what is going on here? And it's intentional to deceive. Other times, it's just someone posting something that isn't true. And that's misinformation. But you need wisdom from heaven to see through that. And I think in our story, to get back to our story, David is looking at this guy thinking, you are not being honest with me at all. And for you to think that this was going to be good news, no way. Do you remember the duck rabbit that I showed you? Right? That is actually used as a reason to say all religions are the same. Because some people see a duck and some see a rabbit and some religions say this and some religions say that. And the intention is to make an illusion. So that whole analogy makes God an illusionist and a deceiver that would make one person think one thing about him and make someone else think something the opposite about him so that there's a conflict in the revelation of God. So that whole idea is simply disinformation to try to deceive people so that they won't believe in God. But really the intention in saying that all religions are the same is to say there is no God. That's what's really the agenda there, because everyone's right, you know, but everyone's wrong because there's no God. So we want to be watching for that. Anyway, back to our story. Verse 17, then, so David is dead, Saul is dead, and David writes this song or this poem, and we're going to read it here the rest of the chapter. And you'll notice here that it says that it's written in the book of Jasher. We don't have the book of Jasher. That means the book of the righteous or the songs of the righteous. maybe a Hebrew songbook from way back when. We don't know what it is. There's possibly this collection of songs like Hannah's song when she had Samuel, Jacob's song, Moses' song, Deborah's song, Joshua, when the sun stands still in his battle, it says that that story is recorded in the book of Jasher. We don't have the book of Jasher, though. So some guy back in the 1700s wrote a book and called it the book of Jasher and said, this is the historical book from the Bible. And it was just a fictional tale. He got put in jail for, I think, 3 years for faking the book of Jasher. So we have no idea what was in the book of Jasher. But let's read this through now, because this is, I want you to notice a couple of things. One, there's no mention of God in this poem. And there's a couple times when David will give us little remnants of things that he had written, poetry and such, that doesn't mention God. So he had all kinds of things that he wrote, and the scriptures collect the ones that he wrote about the Lord. But here is one that he wrote just about the loss of Saul and Jonathan. And by the way, the reference to the book of Jasher, there's a lot of references in the Bible to things that we don't have anymore. In Numbers 21, it speaks of the wars of the Lord, the book of the wars of the Lord. In 1 Chronicles 29, it mentions the book of Gad the seer. We have no idea what that is. The Chronicles of the Kings of Judah, we don't have that. In 1 Kings 14, in 1 Kings 4, it records that Solomon wrote thousands of songs. Did you know that? 1 Kings 4 says that Solomon wrote thousands of songs and 3,000 proverbs. Well, we have his proverbs, but we've only got two psalms that are credited to Solomon. Remember in Acts chapter 17, Paul quoted the prophets, the poet that the Greeks knew. You know, we live and move and have our being in God, quoting one of their poets. In Titus, he quotes and says, one of your own prophets says Cretans are lazy, gluttonous, lazy people, right? And so there's all kinds of little parts in Scripture where books are quoted that we don't really have anymore, or we don't have the reference. So don't let that throw you. So verse 17, then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Real quick, that's exactly what was happening. The Philistines beat Saul, the army in battle, and they were bolstering up themselves. So he's saying, don't proclaim this loss to our enemies, because they'll just use it against us. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you. That's where the battle was. Nor fields of offerings, for the shield of the mighty is cast away there. The shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. So something else I want you to notice is that David praises Saul and Jonathan. He puts them in an absolutely nothing but a good light. I love this about David. Saul was his nemesis, came after him. When he fled to the Philistines, it was because he knew one day Saul would kill him. So he just is a man of incredible character here, and you can see that his heart is genuine. He's not being disingenuous here. Verse 23, Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, And in their death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. So this beautiful expression of honor towards King Saul and his son Jonathan, and the love that he expresses here. And he's talking about that phileo love, you know, that when you've got a friend that's just that kindred spirit. And he's saying this kind of love went deeper than eros love, like between a man and a woman. So I'll make one comment, but don't let me park here too long. The idea that someone would see in this some kind of sexual passion between David and Jonathan is the product of a corrupt mind that would exalt eros as the greatest love. The culture we live in right now is fixated upon sexual passion, eros. So that just is a very disturbing thing. Whenever I hear that brought up, I'm just amazed at how you can miss the fact that what he's saying is friendship can go deeper than intimate passion between a man and a woman. Maybe you have a friend like that. I've had a couple friends in my life that were just very deep friends of mine over the years. And it's true. There's just something about that deep friendship that runs all the way just to the core. Love it. So there can be intimacy in pure friendship that is very rare, and it's to be treasured, just like David treasures Jonathan here. So the mighty have fallen, the weapons perished that fought against them. All who take the sword, Jesus said, die by the sword. But what did Paul say in 2 Corinthians 10? That the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but are spiritual, for the taking down of strongholds, to bring every thought captive to Christ. You know what a really powerful weapon is for us believers? Is to confess our faults one to another and pray for one another. So I have to interrupt myself because my brain's a little foggy tonight. The Bible was written for adults. So as we go through this, it's going to get a little hard to read, right? Death, there's some murder in here, there's deception, there's betrayal, more death. Just a lot. There's a lot in these few chapters that are just hard to read through. We'll read through it. But the application that I'm going to make is always to the inner struggle that we have within ourselves between the flesh and the spirit. Because that's the way I read my Bible. I don't have an external struggle. Now, some believers do. There's evil people that are pursuing them and they're watching their loved ones die for the faith and all of that. But you and I, we don't really have that here. So I try to always remember I can make an application of those things to my life spiritually. So we'll do that, right? Okay, so the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war have perished. Our weapons are spiritual weapons and we don't fight against flesh and blood. Next time someone just rubs you wrong and you just start getting all angry at them, just remember we don't fight against flesh and blood. We fight against principalities and powers and spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places, Paul says, right? And we fight with the strength of Christ. Chapter 2, and it happened after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. And David said, where shall I go up? And he said, to Hebron. So this was a pretty tough area, a lot of hills and tough country, highlands. And so David is going to go there to meet with the men of Judah and be their king. So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. Remember those two? And David brought up the men who were with him, every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. And then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. So David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, you are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown this kindness to your Lord, to Saul, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you. I also will repay you this kindness because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strengthened and be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So David is anointed king over Judah. So this is kind of the largest tribe in the south. And for those of you that are interested, the tribe of Simeon is inside of the tribe of Judah, so that's included. But the tribe of Judah becomes this kind of separate kingdom now that David is reigning over, not the rest of Israel, just the southern tribe of Judah. So verse 8, but Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, right? Saul's now gone, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So Ishbosheth, this is one of the descendants of Saul, is made king over Israel, and he reigned for 2 years. Meanwhile, David is in Hebron, reigning over Judah, and he's there for 7.5 years. And we're going to see, hopefully if we get through this tonight, that he then moves to Jerusalem and sets up his kind of his palace there and everything, and reigns from Jerusalem over all of Israel and Judah. But the first 7.5 years, it's only Judah. So kind of looking at this, I kind of had a math problem. It's like, well, if Ishbosheth is the king of Israel, and he's only king for 2 years, and David is in Hebron, and he's king over, you know, reigning over Judah for 7.5 years, who was reigning for the other 5.5 years over Israel? And I think the clue is in verse 9 here, that Abner, he's the commander of the army, makes him king over, and then look at this list, Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel. These are just separate areas, cities. Ephraim is one of the tribes, Benjamin, another tribe, and then over all Israel. I'm guessing that Abner had to fight back the Philistines in all these areas. Philistines were powerful back then. They just took out Saul and the army, and Abner is trying to gather the troops now and set up Ishbosheth. So I'm going to guess. I have no idea. There's some people that I read on this that would agree that it probably took Abner about 5 years to establish the kingdom for Ishbosheth. So then he reigned for 2 years, and we're going to see that he's killed. So, where did we leave off? Verse 12. Now Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon, and Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David, Joab is David's commander of his military, went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon, and they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other on the other side of the pool. And then Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men now arise and compete before us." This language is very interesting. And Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by number, 12 from Benjamin, followers of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each one grasped his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, which is in Gibeon. Isn't that, now just think how crazy this is. Let's have a few guys go out and fight for us here today, and they all just kill each other and die right away, which creates this huge battle between Abner and his forces for Ishbosheth and Joab and David's servants. And so they start this war right there. So there was a fierce battle that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. I think is how you say that, Asahel. And Asahel was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. Say that three times fast. So Asahel pursued Abner, and in going, he did not turn to the right or to the left from following Abner. And Abner looked behind him and said, "Are you Asahel?" And he said, "I am." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and lay hold of one of the young men and take his armor for yourself." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. So Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I face your brother Joab?" So the commander Abner is, this guy's following him. He knows who he is. He goes, "Hey, are you Asahel? What are you doing? Follow me. You should get some armor if you're going to come after me." He won't. So he's got no armor on. He's just running after Abner to kill him. So Abner says, "You should find easier prey. Get away from me. What are you doing following me?" And this guy won't give up. So verse 23, however, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of his spear so that the spear came out of his back. See, written for adults. And he fell down there and died on the spot. So it was that as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood still. And Joab and Abishai also pursued Abner. And the sun was going down when they came to the hill of Ammah, which is before Gaia, by the road to the wilderness of Gibeon. You know, I tell you, it's hard for me to read these names. I practice, I do. Not as much as Joe practices music, but I do. And then I get up in front of you and I can't do it. And now the children of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became one unit and took their stand on top of the hill. And Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the latter end? How long will it be then until you tell the people to return from pursuing their brethren?" So Abner's playing this card of like, "We're all brothers. Why are you chasing us like this?" And Joab said, "As God lives, unless you had spoken, surely then by morning all the people would have given up pursuing their brethren." In other words, you probably didn't need to say anything. We were going to just quit. So Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and did not pursue Israel anymore, nor did they fight anyone. And then Abner and his men went on all that night through the plain, crossed over the Jordan, and went through all Bithron, and came to Mahanaim. So Joab returned from pursuing Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing of David's servants 19 men and Asahel. And the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin and Abner's men 360 men who died. So David's troops, they lost 19 and Asahel, so 20. Ishbosheth lost 360. So then they took up Asahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron. They got back at daybreak. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. Another context that probably tells us that this was years of trying to establish the kingdom of Israel and the northern tribes again. Meanwhile, David is the king of Judah. So, in the story here, Asahel runs after Abner without any armor. He's kind of relying on, he thinks he can just take him out real fast, I guess. And so he's told, get a simpler enemy. Asahel is the brother of Joab, right? So Joab is a very important character in this book. So I want you to remember Joab is David's commander of his forces, right? And Abner, who's now with Ishbosheth in the northern tribes, just killed his brother, Asahel. Now, he was asking for it. He's coming after him. He won't stop pursuing him. And Joab, just with the blunt end of his spear, just takes him out. And everyone's just kind of standing there going, wow, look what just happened. And but Joab does not forget this at all. Absolutely not. And if we were to make an application, which I'm going to make for you, believer, wear your armor and be careful the enemies that you choose to fight. Make sure that you're fighting the enemy that God is calling you to fight. And make sure you have your armor on. You don't want to rely on your strength to live the Christian life. Now, God sometimes says, Chris, this is what we're working on in your life. This is the situation that you're going to need to walk through and deal with. And I'll say, Lord, can't we just take care of, go back to the other thing that I already had victory over? I'll fight that battle again. That'll be fun. I won that one. Let's go back and do that again. Or I'll choose something else. Lord, let's deal with this in my life. But when God directs me and says, Chris, here's what we're dealing on, then I can operate in his strength because I'm simply surrendering to him and obeying him. Ephesians 6:10, be strong in the Lord and what? In the power of his might, put on the whole armor of God, every piece of it. And then Paul there describes the spiritual armor using a soldier as a kind of a word picture there, but he's talking about truth and righteousness and the gospel and faith and salvation and the word of God. This is what we arm ourselves with so we can rightly fight. So we don't want to rely on our natural ability. We'll get burned out, we'll get wiped out even before God can use us in a situation. Not much unlike Saul, who relied on himself and ended up trying to fight God's anointed David. So we want to make sure that we're pursuing the enemies that God has called us to pursue and not the enemies that God has not called us to pursue. There's a book, you know, the guy that wrote A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23, Philip Keller, right? He wrote another book called Lessons I Learned from a Sheepdog. And he talks about how important it was to rightly train a sheepdog and to make it so the sheepdog would have his eyes on the shepherd, always aware of what the shepherd needed him to do. And he would train his dogs. But when he would get a new dog, they'd be out in the fields with the sheep and the crows would come in. And the dogs would freak out and run after the crows, the new dogs. And they'd jump up in the air and the crows would just fly right above their heads and go over here and land. And the dogs would sprint over to get the crows and the crows would just flutter over here. And the dogs would just get exhausted fighting the crows. And then something else he said, at night when they would make a fire, the dogs, the new dogs, before they were trained, would run after the sparks. So this would just continue to happen. And by the time they were needed to, you know, herd the sheep, they were exhausted and couldn't do what the shepherd needed them to do. And Philip just makes this beautiful illustration for you and I. If we occupy ourselves with the enemies that God is not calling us to pursue, we will get burnt out. We will be useless, tired, tuckered out, and then God will call us to a situation that we need to face in him, and we won't have any strength left. So, believer, listen, we want to wear our armor, and we want to fight those things that God's calling us to fight, not get distracted by other battles. Praise God that there's people that God calls to fight the battles that he's not calling you and I to fight. It's each of us that want, we need to hear from the Lord and be directed by him. Something that I've found is that sometimes God even uses our weaknesses to make us more dependent upon him, and therefore we are used by him in a greater way. I have found that my weaknesses in my life God has used to make me more dependent upon him, which then allows him to use me in a greater way. So when you hear me complaining about a weakness, remind me, Chris, God uses that in your life to you so that he can use you in a greater way. And if I say, oh, huh, then pray for me, right? Because it's absolutely true that God uses the things that we have to walk through that we would have never chosen for ourselves. You know those things where you find yourself having to walk through a season of your life that you would have never chosen for yourself, but God has chosen it so you can trust him in it. And in the end, you find yourself someone who's more dependent on the Lord, which I don't think I can do that for myself. I think I need God to make me more dependent upon him. Chapter 3, verse 2. Sons were born to David in Hebron. Okay, pray for me here. His firstborn was Amnon by Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. His second, Kileab. By the way, he's also called Daniel. And that's by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maachah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Ithream, by David's wife, Eglah. Plenty of names there if you're looking for baby names. These were born to David in Hebron. So obviously David brought on more wives than just the two in the wilderness years. Now it was so, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. Again, that time frame. It's taking some time for Ishbosheth to come to power there. And Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah. So this is Saul, who's now dead, had a concubine, the daughter of Aiah. Is that right? Aiah. So Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine? Then Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hand of David, and you charge me today with a fault concerning this woman? May God do so to Abner and more also if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan, which is the far north, to Beersheba, which is the far south of the land." And he could not answer Abner another word because he feared him. So Abner now has taken this concubine of Saul as one of his wives, and Ishbosheth calls him out on that. So now remember, Ishbosheth only reigned for 2 years. So in all this time, Abner has been working really hard to build the kingdom that would be Ishbosheth's as the king. And then this is brought against him, and he's furious. So he says, "That's it. I'm going to David, but I don't want you to miss this. Few things I don't want you to miss. One is the name calling. In verse 8, am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? So he's slamming the men of Judah. What do you think, I'm from Judah? You think I'm some kind of dog's head from Judah? Well, he's going to flip his loyalty to Judah right here. So it's kind of interesting that he uses that word there. But look at this. May God, in verse 9, do so to Abner and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him to transfer the kingdom to the throne of David. Abner knew that the Lord had already given the kingdom to David, even though he was trying to set it up for Ishbosheth. So I want you to see this. And we see that he's going to go on later on here and say, we all know that God said David's the next king, but he still tries to set up the kingdom for Ishbosheth. I'm just going to say it that I think when you have wealth and authority, security, it's hard to give that up. God calls us to give up our rights and to lay our lives down before him. Abner would have lost his position because Joab was in charge of David's army. He knew that. So he knew he'd lose his position. He knew he'd probably die if he surrendered to David. And so he's trying to hold on to his own life and his own security, even though he knows that God has already chosen David to be the king. It's a great application for you and I that we would surrender all to the Lord. And we'll see that in the next verses as well. So where did we leave off? Oh, he could not answer another word because he feared Abner. He realized Abner was the one that established his kingdom. Verse 12, then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David saying, whose is the land? Saying also, make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel to you. And David said, good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. Remember, Saul gave Michal to him, and the price was, I think it was 100 foreskins of the Philistines to win his daughter. So he did this incredible fighting, brought back 200, and gained Michal. And then Saul had already given her to another man. So let's see here. Verse 14, so David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife, Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. There it is. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Then her husband went along with her to Bahurim, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, go return, and he returned. So they show up to take his wife away, And this guy's like, my wife, and is walking behind her. And Abner says, that's it, you're done with this, go home. So he goes home. Now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, in time past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it, for the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. So there it is. They all knew that God had already told them that he would be the one to establish the kingdom. And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. And then Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David and Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. So Abner and 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to the Lord, to my Lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So Abner has absolutely flipped now to be loyal to David, the rightful king. Verse 22, at that moment, the servants of David and Joab came from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone in peace. When Joab and all the troops who were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner the son of Ner came to the king, and he sent him away, and he is gone in peace. Then Abner came to the king and said, what have you done? Joab, thank you. Then Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you sent him away and he is already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know your going out and your coming in, and to know all that you are doing. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So Joab, you know, you shouldn't have let him go, but really it's because he wanted to kill him for killing his brother. His brother died in battle. This was just a flat-out murder by Joab. Verse 28, afterward, when David heard it, he said, my kingdom and I are guiltless before the Lord forever of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner. Let it rest on the head of Joab and on all his father's house, and let there never fail to be in the house of Joab one who has a discharge or is a leper or who leans on his staff, meaning in weakness, or falls by the sword, or who lacks bread. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel at Gibeon in the battle. And then David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner. And King David followed the coffin, and they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. And the king sang a lament over Abner and said, should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As a man falls before wicked men, so you fell. And then all the people wept over him again. And when all the people came to persuade David to eat food while it was still day, David took an oath, saying, God do so to me, and more also, if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down. This is all in honor of Abner, right? Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner the son of Ner. And then the king said to his servants, Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the sons of Zariah, are too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. So Joab basically commits murder, and David is very aware of what he's done, clears his name and said, this was not me. I did not command this to be done. It's on your head, Joab. But I want you to notice something as we go through this book. David keeps Joab as the commander of his army. He keeps him because Joab never loses a battle. He's an incredible commander. And so David keeps him. He sees the natural gifting and says, we need you. But the problem is, that's what it was. Joab was not a man who honored God and feared God. We're going to see it as we go through the story in this book. Joab, well, he commits murder here. He probably didn't want any competition from Abner. And because of his death of his brother. So he's cursed by David here. And there in verse 39, David says, the Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness. And he was talking about Joab. And so we see through the rest of the book that Joab continues to confirm that he's a self-focused man and his heart is wicked. When Absalom, David's son, rebels against David, David says to Joab, I want you to not kill Absalom. When Joab finds Absalom, he kills him. Totally disregards what David tells him to do. And then David finally says, that's it, Joab, I'm replacing you. So Joab kills the guy that David replaces him with, Amasa. So when Solomon becomes king, David says, Solomon, I want you to do what the Lord would have you do concerning Joab. Take him down to the grave for what he's done. David didn't do it, though. So he asks Solomon to do it. There's this relying on natural resources that is the curse there. When David, and we'll get there in a few chapters, when David falls with Bathsheba and wants to have Uriah killed, he has Joab do it for him. He keeps Joab, this wicked man, close to him because he's so naturally gifted, and it ends up being the one confidant for when he acts wickedly. Of course, we're told not to have an unequal yoking with unbelievers. If you do that, if you keep someone close to you that is not God-fearing, when you stumble, you'll find them to be your friend in your stumbling. So that's why it's really good to have healthy boundaries now. Protect yourself in healthy boundaries now. So on your weakest moments, you've already got that strength established. Well, let's read chapter 4, because you guys are still here. And it finishes kind of our section here. When Saul's son heard that Abner had died in Hebron, right? That's Ishbosheth. He lost heart and all Israel was troubled. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of troops. The name of one was Baana and the name of the other Rechab, the sons of Rimon of Beerothite, of the children of Benjamin, for Beeroth also was part of Benjamin because the Beerothites fled to Gideon and had been sojourners there until this day. Jonathan, Saul's son, and had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled, and it happened as she made haste to flee that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth, We'll pick that up later. Then the sons of Rimon, the Berethite, Rechab and Baana, set out and came at about the heat of the day into the house of Ishbosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon, right? So this is their king. And they came there all the way into the house as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach, and then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. For when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. Then they struck him and killed him, beheaded him, and took his head, and were all night escaping through the plain. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth, too many names, to David at Hebron, and said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day of Saul and his descendants." But David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, and said to them, "As the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, 'Look, Saul is dead,' thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag. The one who thought I would have given him a reward for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth?" So David commanded his young men, and they executed again, cut off their hands and feet, hanged them by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. I want to read the next five verses because it kind of finishes all that we just talked about. Chapter 5, verse 1, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, 'Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh. Also in time past, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, you shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over Israel.'" So see, they all knew. "Therefore, all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. In Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." Father, I thank you. Lord, thank you for your word, and Lord, although this is a little tough to read, Lord, you've recorded this for a reason. And so, Lord, we want to just take in your word as we continue through these stories. We want to hear from you. Lord, I realize that you have tucked a lot of doctrine into the coming stories in this book, so much in the life of David as king. And so, in light of that, we ask that you would direct us by your Spirit. We thank you and praise you in Jesus' name.